Bunty Sujata was born in 1966 in Perth, Australia. Australia, for those of you who don't know, it is the country next to New Zealand on the map. At that stage she had the name Anthony Best, studied literature and philosophy at the University of Western Australia, but after 2 years he gave up his studies and went into the music business, co-founding the indie rock band Martha's Vineyard, which I'd never heard of, but apparently it was quite successful, and I went on YouTube yesterday and listened to some of the songs, and actually you weren't bad, I have to say.
Thank you, very high praise.
And so if you go on YouTube, which I know you'll rush home to do tonight, you can see Anthony Best playing a mean guitar. With a lot more hair than he has at the moment.
And that critical recognition that we've been looking for so long. Not bad.
that's New Zealand for absolutely fantastic, as you know. So it's interesting, that's the kind of looking at YouTube videos, it's a kind of meditation on permanence and impermanence at the same time, because nothing is lost. Sometimes that's rather unfortunate. But when you see it, you know that time has moved on. Anyway, in 1992, Bunty Sujata travelled to Thailand and engaged in intensive meditation practice in that country and in training, eventually being ordained a novice, and then in 1994 as a bhikkhu in, as I said, the lineage of Ajahn Chah, who actually passed away the year you arrived in the country, I understand.
That is correct.
In 1996, Ajahn Sujata returned to Perth and spent more years studying there at Bodhinyana Monastery under Ajahn Brahm, who was one of his main teachers. And then in 2003, he established Santi Forest Monastery in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales, where he served as abbot until 2012. And Santi is a very interesting place. If you'd like to check out the website later, it's a place of practice for nuns and other female practitioners, reflecting Bunty Sujata's interest in and commitment to the revival of the bhikkhuni or nuns ordination in the Theravada tradition in the modern world. In 2005, Bunty Sujata co-founded, there's a lot of co-founding I see in the biography, which is a kind of illustration of Praticca Samuppada, I think. Co-founded Supta Central with two other people, Rod Bucknell and John Kelly. And this is an online digital library of early Buddhist texts that includes translations from the Pali, Chinese and Tibetan languages. And in recent years, Bunty has been focusing on this work, on the work of Sutta Central and on the translation of the suttas of mainstream Buddhism into English, and these translations are freely available on Sutta Central. So it's on this aspect of his work that Bunty Sujata will be speaking to us this evening in a talk entitled Translating a 25,000-year-old sacred text for a modern audience. Bunty Sujata, welcome to Stanford.
Thank you so very much. So it's a very gracious introduction. Thank you for that. Now, first of all, I'm sitting down because I'm lazy. Can everyone hear me? Is that okay? There's plenty of seats up the front if you can't hear me. So I don't want to hear any whinging, all right? Okay. So thank you so much for that, and it's a great honour for me to be here, and thank you to all those who have invited me. And so now I'm officially giving a talk at Stanford, so my mum will be very proud. My dad will pretend he's not proud, and then he'll boast about it to all his friends. And so I'm here to talk about my work with translation, work with Sutta Central. Should we begin? Okay, so first of all, I would like to begin by bringing in a practice which I'm familiar with from Australia, and that is whenever we do an event like this that's of any significance, we always acknowledge the traditional owners of the country. And I know that that's not necessarily widespread practice here in the States, but I still makes me feel comfortable to do that, so if you'll indulge me. And so I would like to express my gratitude and appreciation to the Native Americans on whose land that we live, and to express my gratitude and appreciation for their custodianship and looking after this land for so many thousands of years. And I'd like to pay respects to the elders of the past, present, and future. Now, for this talk, I would like to give a bit of an introduction to what I'm doing, the work we're doing with Sutta Central, my approach to translation, and some various issues that have come up with that translation work. However, I suspect that many of you have probably had long and busy and tiring days, so why don't we do some meditation first? Sure. Does that sound like a good idea? Yes? Everyone happy to do some meditation?
Yes.
Yes, okay, just 10 minutes. If you don't want to do any meditation, that's fine, just sit there and do nothing. Okay. So just 10 minutes of meditation. Inhirangasankumpang Yasanati upamakvachi Adhagamisami nametakanka Evang mangdharehi Adhimutachitanti. Okay, very good. So did everyone enjoy having a few minutes of meditation? That's okay? That's good? Can I ask you some questions about your meditation? Is that okay? You don't have to answer if you don't feel comfortable. But first of all, can I ask how many people were doing breath meditation? Watching the breath when they were sitting there to meditate. Quite a number of people. Okay. Let me have a guess whether this describes your breath meditation. That when you sat down, you tried to watch the breath, but even though you tried to watch your breath, somehow it was hard to keep it in your mind, and all of these thoughts kept on coming in and distracting you from your breath. And you thought you'd take the breath as your object of meditation, but it was hard, it was slippery. Does that, who is that a reasonably accurate description of the meditation that they just did? Okay, fine. That's good. You're normal. Okay, so would it surprise you to know? So this is something that I hear constantly when I'm talking to people about meditation. They describe their meditation in terms somewhat similar to that. Okay? Oh, my meditation object is the breath. I'm trying to pay attention to the breath, but it's hard to keep it in mind. All these thoughts keep coming and distracting me. Would it surprise you to know that the Buddha didn't talk about meditation in that kind of way at all? That many of the concepts and ideas that we use when we discuss about meditation are in fact derived from a much later period of Buddhism, often in fact from the 20th century. And that when we go back and look at the way that the Buddha talked about meditation, he actually used a quite different kind of language to talk about it. So for example, in the basic instructions on mindfulness of breathing meditation, what the Buddha said was, so sato va asasati, sato pasasati. Mindful, one breathes in. Mindful, one breathes out. Yeah? Mindful, one breathes in. Mindful, one breathes out. It's a different way of thinking about meditation, isn't it? It's not like I have that object, which is my breath, and I'm going to try to pay attention to it. Nothing about trying, I'm going to try to focus on it or anything like that. It's a different way of presenting it. A way that, to my mind, feels much more natural. You know, I've been studying suttas and meditating for so many years. It took me 20 years to notice that. To notice that the way that I was meditating and the way that I've been taught to meditate was actually not the same way that the Buddha was talking about it. So this is one of the things which for me is very important and very critical enlivening about looking at what the Buddha's teachings in the suttas is, yes, of course, it's there and then. It's India 2,500 years ago. But it's also here and now. And it's about me and my life and what I'm doing here and now. My first encounter with Buddhism was in northern Thailand at a monastery called Wat Rampang, and I did a 1 month long retreat there. And during that retreat, we weren't allowed to read any books. And in fact, we got virtually no meditation. We got just basic meditation instructions. Almost no teachings about Dhamma or anything like that. So we just learnt purely from our own experience. At the end of that retreat, I asked them, you know, where's show me some reading. And I read a few things, and then I found the suttas. And the first suttas I read were from the Majjhima Nikaya, in the translation by Venerable Nyanamoli, edited by Bhikkhu Kantipala. And when I read those, I knew, this was the real thing. This is what I was looking for. And ever since then, my own spiritual journey has been informed primarily by those two things, by meditation and by the suttas. But also another thing, because it didn't take me long, given that I'm a mischievous and difficult character, it didn't take me long to start asking questions of my teachers in that monastery, because in that was a Vipassana center, and so they always talk about these jnanas, right? Vipassana jnanas they're talking about. And so I read a few suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, and I couldn't find anything about these jnanas. But the suttas, like every second sutta, seems to be talking about these things called jhanas. I didn't know what that was. No one had mentioned anything. So I asked my teachers, what are these jhana things that I keep coming across in the suttas? Oh, that's the explanation I got was, well, that's what the Buddha practiced, but it's not what he taught his students to do. Okay? Is that right? I don't know. I didn't know anything. I was just starting out. I thought, okay, well, that's the explanation. Fine. And we proceed. So it's some idea that sometimes what we hear around us, and sometimes what the traditions have passed down to us, and what different teachers and different schools are giving us, they're giving us different perspectives on the teachings. And so if we want to look at what the Buddha thought and how the Buddha taught them, we look at the suttas, and that gives us a framework for understanding what these different teachers are teaching and why they're teaching it and all of that stuff. So of course this is a big issue, I think, in contemporary Buddhism, because, you know, I'm sure in California it's probably the worst place in the world to learn Buddhism, because there's like every different kind of Buddhism is here. There's probably like a new Buddhist center and school every weekend that's opening up. And so to me, by understanding the suttas and understanding what lies at the roots, you can understand what is informing all of these traditions. Right? So it's not a matter of saying one's right and one's wrong or anything like that, but it's a matter of understanding where are they coming from and how do they relate to them. Because all of these different traditions and teachers are drawing upon things which are found in the suttas in one way or another. Now, again, before I go on, if I may ask just a few more questions, because I don't know you lot, okay? Now, I can see there's obviously we have some venerables here in robes, so I assume that you know something. Excellent. But as for the rest of you, I don't know how much you know about Buddhism or anything like that. So can I ask you a few questions and give you a bit of a test? Is that all right? Okay, so can somebody tell me what is a sutta? It's not a trick question. Just a simple answer will do. Okay. Okay. Okay, so similar to a sutra, but then what is a sutra? Sutra is a Sanskrit spelling. Yes. Sutra is a Pali spelling. So what is a sutra then?
Instruction.
Okay. So we usually translate a sutta as a discourse. And in a Buddhist context, so a sutta is typically a particular teaching which is given at a particular time and place, usually by the Buddha or by one of his disciples. Okay. So the text that I'm going to be speaking about today are going to be the root texts are in Pali. So can somebody, and I'm going to exclude, if you don't mind, the Venerable Sangha from this, because you'd be cheating, okay, because you're experts. But somebody who's not the monks and nuns, what is Pali?
Language of 20th and this part.
Okay. The language that's spoken in Lumbini and around that area, okay? And what time period are we talking about?
I don't know from when it was stopped, but is there
Actually, 3,000 years ago.
3,000 years ago. That's fighting words. Okay. It's an ancient Indian languages. 3,000 years is probably a bit old, but the Buddha lived roughly 2,500 years ago, and the Buddha spoke Pali or something very much like Pali. So there's similar languages around the area. If you read the Ashokan inscriptions, which date a little bit after the Buddha, then they're in a language called Magadhi, which is very similar to Pali. Okay, so there's a bit of scholarly to and froing about the question about whether the Buddha actually speak Pali or what's the relationship between these different languages, but I won't get too much into those details here and now. Although, if you want to ask questions, you're most welcome to do so. So we've established a few basic details. So the Buddha taught discourses. Those discourses are in the Pali language. Next question is, how did those discourses come to us? I mean, that's 2,500 years of history, but very briefly, can anybody tell us something about how 2,500-year-old teachings by a wandering mendicant in ancient India came to be discussed in Stanford in 2019?
They were recited.
Excellent. Very good. So the initial tradition was an oral tradition, recitation of scriptures. Okay, very good. Later on, they were written down on palm leaf manuscripts. So starting maybe 500 years after the Buddha or so, they were written down on palm leaf manuscripts and passed down on palm leaf manuscripts until the modern period. So late 19th century and 20th century, those palm leaf manuscripts were made into paper editions of books. And so that was for 100 years or so, and now we use computers to read them. Okay, and of all of those different mediums for doing them, I have memorized suttas, so I know something about the oral tradition. I've not ever made a palm leaf manuscript, but I probably should do so. I've read books and I've digital manuscripts, digital texts, and I can tell you digital is the worst. Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, that's what we've got, so this is what we do. So, we have these scriptures. And these scriptures are a very important source, clearly a very important source, probably the most important source for understanding the early period of Buddhism. Now, let me just give you a very brief rundown of the historical situation at that time when the Buddha taught. He taught for 45 years. There was a large community of monks, nuns, laymen, and lay women who learned from him. After his death, they got together and organized these teachings into various collections. And those collections variously called the Tripitaka or the Nikayas and so on and so forth. And those collections were passed down in the different communities. Over time, the communities split apart. And we have various of those scriptures which are inherited from ancient India. Only a small fraction of what there once was, but we have a complete collection in Pali, which was preserved in Sri Lanka. We have a large number of texts that were translated into Chinese. We have a significant but somewhat smaller number translated into Tibetan, and a various scattering of things in Sanskrit and Gandhari and some other Indic languages. Okay, so that's just a rough survey of the literature that we call the early Buddhist literature, which is that which comes from that earliest period of Buddhism. Now, in modern times, since the 19th century, there has been a recognition of the value of the Pali literature in particular, and that literature has been studied, published through the Pali Text Society, and translated by various scholars. And that's one of the major means by which many of us have gained access to the Dhamma. Now, this whole field is still very young and very immature. And most of the Pali texts have been Pali canonical texts have been translated into English, but not all of them. Of the Chinese early Buddhist texts, only a small proportion have been translated into English, maybe 10% if that. of the other ones, Tibetan, Sanskrit and so on, also only a small proportion have been translated into English. In many cases, in different Buddhist communities throughout Asia, these texts don't necessarily play much of a role in the community. Okay? Now, I grew up in a Catholic background, and we would go to Mass every week, and every week they would read from the Bible. So even if you weren't really interested in it or didn't really know anything, then after you've done that for 10 years, you'd at least have a fair idea of what's in the Bible. Whereas in the Asian countries, they don't really have that tradition. And so people don't really know what's in their sacred scriptures, like, at all. And I think it's really important to understand. It's hard to appreciate the fact if you haven't really lived in some of those countries. I'll just give you one of many anecdotes that I could tell you. But when I was, say, for a monk in Thailand, stayed as a monk in northern Thailand for a year in a province called Nan, and the owner of the hut that I was staying in was an ex-monk himself. He'd been a monk for about 3 years. And one day we visited another monastery, and I borrowed from there a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya, one of the Buddhist scriptures, and we were driving home just to read the Majjhima Nikaya. And he said, "Oh, what's that? What have you borrowed?" I said, "Oh, this is some suttas. This is the Majjhima Nikaya." He said, "What's the Majjhima Nikaya?" He's never heard of it. So he's been a monk for 3 years. And the word Majjhima Nikaya, literally, he's never heard of it. Can you imagine talking to a Christian priest and, like, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, ring a bell? And so the role that these things play, and I know we have some Sri Lankan venerables here who are looking puzzled and cross at me, because obviously that wouldn't be the case in Sri Lanka, right? Because in Sri Lanka they obviously have a much better understanding of what suttas are. Now obviously some monks in Thailand do, but the education system is such that it doesn't really focus on what the suttas are. They study other things. They study more contemporary texts and various other things that they do. Now, personally, I feel this is a bit of a shame. I feel that for all of us who are interested in Buddhism, that it's really important to have at least some understanding and some grounding in what these teachings in the suttas are. And, you know, certainly as monastics or people who have a serious dedication to the path, but I also think that anybody who's interested in a serious study of Buddhism, no matter what period or what kind of Buddhism you're studying, you should have at least some familiarity with what we have in the early Buddhist texts, just as anyone who's doing a serious study of Christianity should have some understanding of what the Bible contains, or anyone who's studying Islam should know what the Quran contains. And so in a way, I see my work and the work that I'm doing with Sutta Central as hopefully making Paul's job easier by getting the students who come to your door having already read the suttas. This is what I would like to see. I would like to see this be a normal part of a kind of Buddhist-interested education, that people can read the suttas and have a reasonable idea of what's in them. And one of the biggest obstacles we face is the lack of good translations. So this is one of the things that I really wanted to do with Sutta Central, was to try to make translations available and accessible to people. Okay, so that's just giving you a little bit of a background, an introduction to what I'm doing here and why I'm doing it. All right? Now, I'm going to go on to have a little bit more of a detailed look at what I'm doing with Sutta Central, but before I do that, I'd like to invite any questions. Dankin manyata avaso. Any questions? Thoughts? Comments? No? Gentlemen at the back. Sorry?
How long it took the process of translating?
Of translating?
How long it took?
I'll talk about my translation project in just a minute, but the main project took about 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. Okay. So are we good? I'll just make sure that we're not going too fast or too slow. We're all okay? All right. Tell me if I'm going too quickly, then tell me. If I'm going too slowly, then just yell out, "Hurry up, we know this stuff," okay? Okay, very good. Okay, so briefly look at Sutta Central and what we do here. So Sutta Central is about early Buddhist texts, translations and parallels. Let's have a quick look at a typical example of a sutta here on Sutta Central. Let's take as a simple example Majjhima Nikaya number 1, the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, which I translate as the root of all things. And so here we have a card that gives you the information about this sutta. We have a few different translations of that text. We have the root edition of the text, which is derived from the Mahasangiti edition of the Pali Canon, which is a corrected version of the Chattisangayana Tripitaka from the Vipassana Research Institute. We have 22 translations in other languages, right? So Bengali, Czech, German, Spanish, and so on. So one of the major jobs that we've done for many years is to gather the different translations which have been done by various kinds of people in different languages. When I say people, it's not necessarily limited to people. We also do have the Metta Sutta in Klingon. So we don't discriminate against, like, if you're alien or human being or whatever, that's fine, okay? They're not quite sure if I'm serious. Do you think I'm serious? Oh, I can show you. There we go. Mine, Kodaka Nikaya, Kodaka Pata. So, for example, here we have the Metta Sutta. And here we have the Sindarin version for any talking geeks. And here's the. So, this is in Sindarin. So, this is the language of the elves in The Lord of the Rings. Nice, right? And I'm sure that if I could speak Sindarin, it would also sound very nice. But unfortunately, I can't.
So, was this translation from the Pali?
That was from the Pali, or probably from the English, actually. Yeah, most translations made from the English. Most elves tend to know the English. And this is the Klingon. Okay. So anybody, any trickies here? No? No one's willing to admit it? Okay. All right, so where were we? Oh, we were doing something sensible before. Right, okay. So, right, here we go, back to the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, so we have the text, the translations, and we also have the parallels. And I'll just briefly talk about this so we get an idea of what's going on. So the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, one of the discourses in the Majjhima Nikaya, fairly typically for a Majjhima Nikaya discourse, has a few parallels. And this particular one has three parallels in Chinese. Okay? So these are discourses which are similar to the Pali discourse, which were taken to China and translated, usually around the 4th century. Most of the translations were done. And part of different collections. So this one is part of the Ekottarika Agama, this one part of the Majjhima Agama, and this one an independent sutta collected in the Taisho Chinese Tripitaka. And so we have the Chinese text for these as well. So this is a fairly typical example. And this is another kind of parallel that we have on Sutta Central. This is a mention. So what this means is that in this particular text, which is an Abhidhamma text, the Kadawattu, this discourse is mentioned. The Abhidhamma text is quoting from it and having a discussion about a passage from this discourse. So this is some of the information which we're bringing together and gathering together on Sutta Central. And we've done this work of gathering the different translations and so on for a number of years now. Now, when we were doing this work, we reached a bit of a impasse about 4 or 5 years ago because we weren't able to source high-quality English translations of all of the suttas. Now, there are, of course, translations of virtually all of the suttas, but there are problems. In some cases, the translations are not very good. In some cases, they are protected by copyright. So we're not able to get hold of them. We tried to negotiate to get hold of suttas that we could publish, and we couldn't do it. So what do we do? Well, we either have gaps, and I think this is a real... I think it's a bit embarrassing, to be honest, from a Buddhist point of view, that we don't even have like a good translation of our basic scriptures freely available. I think it's kind of embarrassing. I felt embarrassed. And so I tried to figure out a way of getting this done. How do we get the good quality translations done that would be freely available? And I went through many different scenarios and had many discussions about this, and at the end of it I got very frustrated and then said, bugger it, I'll do it myself. So that's what I did. So I was lucky enough to be able to find some time off and went to an island, the island, lovely island of Chi Mei off the coast of Taiwan, where I was very fortunate to be supported there to do my translation work, and stayed there for about 2.5 years just doing translations, essentially. So basically get up in the morning, do my practice, and then start working, and then read Pali and write the English. That's it. That was my life. And my only regret is that there's just not enough suttas. Because by the time I finished it, I was like, oh, I'd really love to keep doing this. But I ran out of suttas, so I couldn't keep on going. So in that period, I translated the four Nikayas, four Pali Nikayas from Pali to English, which are these texts here on the side. You can see the these are the main sections. So the long discourse, or Digha Nikaya, the middle discourses, or Majjhima Nikaya, linked discourses, or Sanyutta Nikaya, and numbered discourses, or Anguttara Nikaya. So that's about 1 million words in Pali, and I translated those into English. So, what somebody asked me before, like what is the aims, or what is there that distinguishes the translations that I'm doing from previous translations? Now, the first thing to acknowledge is that translation is an inherently imperfect process. And I'm sure there's a number of people here. Is there anyone here who's worked on translation work? Yeah, a few people here? Okay, excellent. So, right? It's bad, isn't it? Yeah? When I came to this end of 2.5 years, I realized that it was like each word that you're translating is like Schrodinger's cat. Right? It's this fuzzy ball of possibilities and probabilities, and you have to sort of, you've got this cat and you don't know if it's alive or dead. And it could be, have so much potential, right? It could be so many things, and you have to open up the box and say it's got to be this thing and not that thing. And you've got to kill Schrodinger's cat. For those of you not familiar with it, this is purely a thought experiment. No cats were harmed in the process. But it feels like it, right? Feels like, oh, there's so much in there, and I can only just get like this tiny little bit. And so whenever you do translations, sort of one of the hobbies of people who read Buddhist texts and things like that is to read them and say, oh, this is wrong and that wrong, and it's not dependent origination, it's dependent co-arising, and it's not impermanence, it's change, and it's not whatever. And so we all have our famous ways, favorite ways of translating things. And, you know, if you mention that to any translator, they'll go, oh, I know, I know. And we're just trying to do the best, and we're fully aware of how imperfect everything that we're doing is. So, the aims of my particular translation project, number one, I wanted to make a translation that would be accurate, obviously. Number two, I wanted to make a translation that was in plain English. Alright? And in Buddhist studies circles, there's a kind of in-house joke about what we call Buddhist hybrid English. And Buddhist hybrid English is essentially the kind of weird dialect into which Buddhist texts are forced because translators, I don't know why, but anyway, because it's hard, right? It's hard to actually figure out how to say things in a better way. You know? So anyway, so try to translate it as much as possible so that it would sound like something that someone might actually say. Huh? At the same time, I wanted to translate it in a way that's consistent. Okay? And especially that would be consistent across all of the four Nikayas. this is something just maybe just give you a little bit of background as to this. Those of you who are not familiar with the Buddhist text, and especially with the Pali Buddhist texts, might not appreciate the extent to which we find repetition and we find the deployment of a whole range of highly formal linguistic and technical devices like statement and repetition, variation of cases, all of these kinds of things. And the language is highly formalized in many ways. And one of the things that we find is that one of the challenges is you phrase something in the positive form and it works fine, but then you've got to phrase it in the negative form and then that doesn't work fine, so you've got to go back and change it again. Now, as English translators worked, they, especially in the early days, there wasn't a lot of consistency or coherency in how they dealt with all of these challenges. In fact, if you look closely at them, you'll commonly find that they might translate the same word or the same phrase in different ways in the next sentence, not to mention the next paragraph or the next chapter. So, I mean, look, fair enough. They didn't have computers and they were translating difficult and large texts they didn't have the resources. And that changed in the 1950s with a monk called Venerable Nyanamoli. And he was really a pivotal figure in Pali translation, and he introduced a degree of rigor and consistency into Pali translation which really has upped the game for everybody since then. Bhikkhu Bodhi, of course, a very famous scholar monk today, inherited Venerable Nyanamoli's translation, like literally the draft that Nyanamoli had made of the Majjhima Nikaya was Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's first translation project. So Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation style is not identical, it's a bit different from Nyanamoli, but still it's not too different. It's more or less evolving the same translation approach that Nyanamoli used. And again, I would see my translation style as more or less evolving that same kind of idea. So the basic idea would be that you try to translate the same technical term or the same phrase in the same way each time it occurs, unless there's a reason not to. Obviously, sometimes words mean different things in different contexts, so we have to translate it differently, that's fine. But unless you need to, you don't just translate it differently because you forgot what you translated last time, which happens like constantly. So I can't guarantee it, but this is the idea, is to translate it so it's consistently, so that if you want to look for a particular idea across the canon, then you should be able to search and you should be able to find that idea across the canon. All right? So just to recap, I wanted it to be a accurate translation. I wanted it to be plain English. Oh, I should mention about the plain English thing before going on. Like, plain English is not my native idiom. My native idiom is kind of complicated and convoluted English. And so it's quite a bit of effort to figure out how to write plain English. And one of the big motivating factors for me doing that has been the fact that for most of my adult life, I've lived in Asia, or I've lived closely together with Asian people, and a lot of people who speak English as a second language. And I realized how much of an obstacle it is to reading the suttas to have things phrased using, complicated and convoluted words. So, for example, a phrase like one that always struck me was one generates demeritorious volitional formations. It kind of rolls off the tongue, right? One generates demeritorious volitional formations. So my translation of that is one makes bad choices. So hopefully it's a bit easier to understand. So I wanted to do something that you didn't have to do a PhD to understand. Right? Now, of course, this is all relative, right? I mean, there are plenty of suttas. In fact, this particular sutta, the Mulaparyaya Sutta, which is inherently difficult. I mean, it's a highly sophisticated discourse. And it's a bit unfortunate that it's put there at the beginning of the Majjhima Nikaya, because a lot of people are going to pick it up and read it and go, what is this about? There's a lot more accessible ones, actually. But that's the intrinsic nature of the subject. So we still want to try to make it so that the language is as accessible as possible. So make it as simple as it can be, but no simpler. And just to be clear, because sometimes people don't get this, it doesn't mean that the text is dumbed down. Right? I'm still trying to represent the text as accurately possible, and if that means using a more complicated word, then that's fine. You use a more complicated word. But try to make it no more complicated than necessary. So number one, again to recap, as the Buddha always did, it is accurate, it's consistent, it's plain English, it's consistent, it's complete, so a complete translation of the four Nikayas, and also free of copyright. Okay? So this is another issue, and it's an issue about which I have strong opinions. So hopefully I'm not going to offend anybody. When I say hopefully I'm not going to offend anybody, I mean hopefully I will offend somebody. Now, Buddhist texts have always been passed down for the good of humanity. And personally, I believe it's completely inappropriate to place any Buddhist scriptures, I'm speaking about ancient Buddhist scriptures, not about modern Buddhist texts, I think it's completely inappropriate to place any of them under any copyright. I don't think there's any legal basis for placing any original text under copyright, and yet we find that constantly, like almost every source that I've found of, I'm speaking now not of translations, of original text, almost every source makes some kind of copyright claim. And I believe that none of these have any legal basis. In fact, I believe it may well be illegal to make those claims. You can't just go around and claim to own something that you don't own. These are ancient spiritual texts, and the fact that I may have edited and published an edition does not give me ownership over that text. Now, as far as translations go, under Western modern copyright law, a translation is considered to be an original creative product and hence is subject to copyright. But in Buddhism, that's not the case. In Buddhism, a translation is still felt to be the words of the Buddha in the same sense as the original text. And all of the texts which are studied in China, in Chinese, are felt to be the words of the Buddha. All the texts studied in Tibetan are felt to be the words of the Buddha. And so the Buddhist perspective is that these are not an original creative act. And look, I did not feel like personally I was making an original creative act by making these translations. And I'm aware that that's subjective and different people will have different opinions on that. But I think it's important to acknowledge that from the perspective of the Buddhist traditions, translations are always equivalent to the words of the Buddha. And so I don't believe that it's appropriate for any translator of any ancient Buddhist texts to claim copyright over those texts. Anyway, maybe some more discussion about that could be had at a later time. But certainly I felt that for myself, that I didn't want to claim translation of it, so I put it out there. It's all public domain. We make the source files available. And if you don't like the way that I've translated sankharas, then do a find and replace and translate it the way that you want. It doesn't belong to me. All right? So that's all. Okay. So any questions, anything before I go on to the next bit? Yeah.
Do you find a difference in translation between practitioners who maybe have a different understanding of the Dhamma versus academics who maybe have different kind of interests? Granted, there might not be some continuity between the two, but do you feel there's a different kind of spirit in the translation that results in different
Did everyone hear that question? Yeah. So, do I feel the difference? Yes, I think, but I don't think necessarily that one is better than the other, and I think there's definitely something to be learned from both. I mean, one thing I'm always interested in like the quirks and oddities of history. Like, for example, like you go around California and San Francisco, and it's like mindfulness everything. We were in. Where was the town we went for Pinabat the other day? In Sebastopol, and there's like the mindful, there's something mindful building, right? So it's like a construction company that does mindful building. Okay? Look, fair enough, right? I'd rather have my builder be mindful than not mindful, right? Absolutely, I think this is great. But, of course, we forget, obviously, mindfulness is an idea which is taken from the Buddhist text, but equally obviously, the Buddha never talked about mindfulness. He talked about sati. And in the 19th century, an English scholar called Thomas Rhys-Davies translated sati as mindfulness. Now, Rhys-Davies wasn't a meditator, right? I mean, he was somebody who had a lot of sympathy, a lot of empathy for the Buddhist traditions. And somehow he latched onto this word that somehow worked. I mean, a lot of the other choices he might have made didn't work, but that particular one somehow stuck. And that has informed and changed the lives of so many people. So I think that that there are... What's really the critical thing with translation is to recognize that any translation is limited by the perspective of the translator, and to appreciate what qualities that a particular translator can bring to it. Yeah. On a more practical level, typically if you look at a more scholarly translation, so I mean the exemplary case for Pali translations would be those by the English scholar K.R. Norman, who translated in a way that's almost kind of algebraically literal. And so they're very useful for understanding the grammar, the structure of the sentences, for things like the etymology and so on. And his work is incredibly useful. But it's not great to actually read, right? So it's great as a reference work. So I think that there's something that can be learned from everyone. Okay. So here we have might as well just read out a sutta. So here is one of my suttas translations, Crossing the Flood, Sanyutta Nikaya, number 1.1, a fairly random choice of sutta. And I'd like to just read it out because this literature, as was pointed out earlier, is originally an oral literature. So have I heard. At one time the Buddha was staying near Sarvati in Jeta's grove in Atpindika's monastery. Then late at night, a glorious deity lighting up the entire Jeta's grove went up to the Buddha, bowed, stood to one side and said to him, "Good sir, how did you cross the flood?" "Neither standing nor swimming, sir, I crossed the flood." "But in what way did you cross the flood, neither standing nor swimming?" "When I stood still, I went under, and when I swam, I was swept away. That's how I crossed the flood, neither standing nor swimming. After a long time, I see a Brahman extinguished, neither standing nor swimming. He's crossed over clinging to the world." This is what that deity said, and the teacher approved. Then that deity, knowing that the teacher approved, bowed and respectfully circled the Buddha, keeping him on his right, before vanishing right there. So on sort of central, because it's awesome, you can now see the translation and the text as well. So which actually reminds me of one other thing which I was doing with the translation. It's a more technical side of the translation, but when we did this translation, what we did was that we divided the Pali text, the entire Pali Tripitaka, into segments, all right, which you can see here. And a segment is essentially a kind of a meaningful, translatable blob of text. It might be a sentence or a line of verse or something like that. And then it's translated more or less segment by segment. Right? I mean, sometimes there's a bit of wiggle room because language is wobbly. And so this allows us to match text and translation segment by segment. It allows us to do a number of cool things. For example, we can... simply assign a number to each one of those, and then we can have a numbered reference to one of those segments. So I can now share that URL for that, and then I can reference that particular segment of that text. For those of you who have been studying Pali text or something, will know that the more traditional scholarly way of referencing it is by the volume and page number of the Pali Text Society edition, which is fairly archaic and not very granular. Right, so here we are able to reference things in a much more precise way. Another thing which this supports, and which we are moving towards is being able to support third language translations. So most of the time, you know, I've showed we have 20, actually up to 40 languages on Sutter Central, and almost all of those are translated from English. All right? So they're translated from English to French or from English to Russian and so on. Not in every case. In some cases, they're translated directly from Pali, but mostly they're translated from English. And so we're building a software which is going to help to support translators to be able to do this. And I think it's worth remembering that we don't have, like, in Buddhism, we don't have, like, big institutes and, you know, organizations who are doing all of this stuff. Right? There's not like millions of dollars being pumped into this. You've got me and a few mates who are running sort of central, and all of the different groups are like that. You know, there's a few academics in Hungary who get together and make some translations, and they've done a great job of making a website for Pali Suttas in Hungarian. In Spain, there's another mob is doing one. In India. There's like two or three monks who, working in the 20th century, translated most of the Pali canon into Hindi. Other examples. In Indonesia, there's a couple of groups who are doing translation, and so on. So it's just a few individuals, maybe a volunteer, somebody doing a bit of work when they get home, you know, after a long day's work, and doing it all together. So we want to try to support the volunteers so that they can focus on doing the translation, and then we can handle like building the software and all of that kind of stuff, so that we can keep on getting a better, more complete and more consistent translation across all of these languages. So this is a long-term project, and we're really looking, you know, maybe 10 years, 20 years down the track to generate a whole new set of translations of the Pali texts. And in addition to that, we're also working on Chinese and Sanskrit, and possibly eventually Tibetan texts as well, to translate them. We'd like to translate the whole corpus, but what can I say? And then we have, of course, wonderful volunteers like Carl, who's sitting over there, who has done an incredible job of making the translations available through a voice interface. So this is for people with sight difficulties, maybe can't read suttas, or maybe people who just like to listen to suttas. We found a lot of people like that who just like to listen. And so he's made a great interface that can actually read the suttas for you. So this is some of the benefits that we have by creating an open data system. Not by locking everything up and controlling it, but by encouraging and supporting different people to try to do different work. So this, again, is part of the thing. And for me, it's part of the journey, because I make all of these great friends everywhere. It's fantastic. Okay, so again I pause, and again I invite for questions. You guys are a pretty quiet lot. Okay, we have a couple of questions at the front. Okay, good. Yes, I have.
You mentioned that most of the translations in third languages are coming from English rather than Pali.
Yep.
And I can imagine why that might be, but I'd like you to say a bit about that. And then doesn't that also put a lot more fear in the heart of the translator of English? Because it seems like it's compounding the losses.
Yeah, okay, so yes, translations are made primarily from English. I mean, the brute fact at the end of that is that it's always going to be like that. It's the same way for Bible translations, right? Most Bible translations are made from English, because you don't have 500... you know, Bible translators in 500 languages. Most, say if you use Google Translate, right? Google Translate works through English. So if I translate from French to German, it goes French to English, English to German, German to English, English to French. Right? That's the only practical, really, way to do it. Unfortunately, that's just how it is. So our aim was to facilitate translating, improving the way this is translated, and I can give you a bit of a sneak peek at this perhaps, let's see if it works. But we're building a translation software called Bilara, which is dedicated to doing just this job. Let's have a look at that same sutra I just looked at. And that's a bug. Let me see if that works. Oh, there we go. So this is that same sutta we just read, and so this is in Bilara, our translation software. And as you can see, you click on it, and it'll pop you up with a reminder of a previous translation of that same section. So that's basically how that works. And so this is still in trial stage, but when that's developed, then we'll use this for doing the third-party translations. So the idea is that at least they can have the Pali there, as well as the English. Yeah. Okay. Yes, you have a question.
Yeah, I'm curious how you felt like when you were translating these texts, how that impacted your actual meditation practice. Like,
uh-huh.
Did you find that it supplemented it? Did you find that sometimes it detracted from it? Did you find there was sort of a happy medium you had to sort of establish between the two? I'm curious how those two interrelated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the long term, I certainly find it's, you know, it's incredibly supportive because, you know, it just gives you, there's so much faith and there's so much, like, reassurance and all of those things. So, of course, yes, sometimes, you know, you might be sitting in the evening and you're like, oh, it's nice and peaceful. Oh, hang on. Yes, no, that was that word, right? Oh, okay. So, yes, of course, that happens sometimes. But, see, the thing is that you get to sit and when you're reading, you're getting to listen to the Buddha talking to you, right? All day, and like he's not messing around, and you know you can see this quality of speech which the Buddha has. I mean, by some coincidence, this was in I was doing this in 2016. So in the morning I'd read the paper and it would tell me about what's happening in the American elections. And I'd see the quality of speech which is being used. And then I'd see the quality of speech which is being used by the Buddha. And I was so glad I was able to listen to the Buddha. Yeah. Yes?
How can you learn, how could you learn Pali?
How could I learn it?
Yes, I mean...
Right? Seems crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How did I do it? I taught myself. Yeah. Yeah.
There's a book, there's probably dictionaries.
There's dictionaries and books and these kinds of things, yeah. So the main book I used to learn Pali was A.K. Warder's Introduction to Pali. And, I mean, I was in monasteries. So, of course, in a monastery, it's obviously very supportive, and we're like reciting Pali, like it's still an active liturgical language in the Theravada traditions. So I memorized, for example, I memorized our Padimokkha, so the rule of rules for the monks that we recite every fortnight. So you're memorizing fairly large amounts of Pali, and you know it's in the language that people are using every day, right? I mean, you end up speaking this kind of weird half Pali, half Thai hybrid when you're talking to the other monks, right? You know, you're going to go and sit samadhi or something like that and you forget that you're actually talking Pali. So you pick up a lot of words. So then I just applied myself to the study of the grammar. It's not too bad. Pali grammar's not too bad, is it? It's all right. Yeah.
One question. Do you also plan to make the text available in the original scripts in which you're reading?
In the original scripts in which they are written, such as?
I don't know, is this text written in Sinhala or Devanagari or...
Okay. Yeah, there's in Sinhala. Mm-hmm. And there's in Devanagari. So there you go.
Oh, fantastic.
All right. So one thing to bear in mind is that there really isn't an original script for Pali. People often ask this, you know, people like want to get tattoos and I want to get the tattoo of metta in the real Pali script. And I ask them, and Pali doesn't have a real script because all the Indic languages, of course, are phonetically spelled. So you can actually use any language, any script for them, any of the Indic scripts, and that will represent Pali perfectly well. So typically the Pali Tripitaka, Pali scriptures and commentaries and other literature, was written in the local script. So in Sri Lanka it would be Sinhalese script, actually earlier in Brahmi script and later in Sinhalese script, in Thai script and so on. So actually in Thailand, often in Khmer script. But anyway. Yes.
No, I was going to say, where is the largest repository of Pali scriptures?
Where? What do you mean by define largest?
When you are translating from Pali to English, where do these repositories of Pali scriptures, where are they? Where is the largest repository?
The ones that I was using, you mean? You mean the text that I'm using?
Where do they reside? Where are
physically
they?
Where they reside?
Yeah. In the world.
Yeah, all over. Yeah, it's an interesting question. All over the Theravada Buddhist world, you will find manuscripts in all of the monasteries. Basically, not all the monasteries, but a lot of the monasteries will have manuscripts. And many of those manuscripts are manuscripts of Pali texts. But they might have other things as well, like histories and grammars and various things, but a lot of them are manuscripts of Pali texts. I don't know if there's a single place that has the largest one, but the edition, the modern editions that we use are based on manuscripts from the 18th and 19th centuries. Okay? These manuscripts were collected from, the editors tried to collect manuscripts from Thailand, Burma and Sri Lanka and use them to create the editions that we read today, which have been digitized and we're in front of us. So one of the projects that we have as part of Sutta Central is to digitize the oldest known Pali manuscript, which is a 13th century manuscript of the book called the Chulavaga, which has been in the Colombo National Museum for the last century. And it's been sitting there, they've preserved it well in the museum, but nobody's actually edited it and read it. So this is one of the projects that we're undertaking at the moment. Yes. Okay.
I found that inevitably the translator is actually doing the interpreting of the words.
Of course, yeah.
So to be able to see several choices side by side is tremendous value.
Yeah.
I have two things that I've been asking you. What interpretation of the word sati that would be your favorite?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is when you started talking about how the Buddha taught the mindful, like the anatta.
Right.
What if you? I'm kind of hoping that you would talk a little bit more because I would be interested to hear a different interpretation of how the Buddha instructed us to approach this meditation.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that. So, on the thing that you mentioned before about seeing different people's perspectives, I always one of the most. Okay, I'll tell you two ideas which have been really useful for me in doing the translation. Number one was a point that I got from my friend Ajahn Brahmali when we were discussing this. And he said that, he made, I think, the quite reasonable point that the Buddha was fairly sensible. Okay? On the whole. Right? And that when he said something, it meant something. Right? So, if we translate it in a way that means nothing, we're obviously making a mistake. So we should try to figure out as best we possibly can what it was that this sentence is saying. And it should mean something. Even if we're not quite sure what that is, we translate it in the best way that we can. And if we're wrong, fine. Let somebody tell us we're wrong and we can fix it. But don't sort of hide behind. And the point he's getting at is that when translating, it's very tempting to hide behind literalism. Right? The dictionary says it's this word, so I'm just going to put that word in there, and good enough. No one can tell me I'm wrong because I can just point to the dictionary. Yeah? And look, I have to confess, sometimes you've got to do that. Because sometimes you really just actually don't quite know what it means. So you do make your best guess. And there's always that element of uncertainty, but you try to translate it in a way that's meaningful. So this is one principle that's really useful for me. The other principle, which I learned actually from, I'm sure it's in a garbled form, but I learned from a discussion of Bible translation. Actually, I've learned a lot about textual criticism and text handling text from studying Bible studies, text critical studies of the Bible, because they tend to be much more sophisticated and much more developed than studies of Buddhist texts. But one of the principles that I picked up from there was I call the principle of least meaning. Okay? The principle of least meaning. And the idea there is that we tend to overinterpret things. We tend to read things into things, and especially when it comes to ancient sacred texts, we read this great burden of meaning into the smallest word or the smallest phrase. And it's somehow it's a process of having compassion for that. Like, this is just a small little word. You don't kind of pile this huge big meaning on top of it, right? It's just a word. It's just saying what it says. So you try to translate it in a way that will just translate it as thinly as possible, that will bring across the most basic, ordinary, everyday meaning of the word, rather than trying to imbue the word with your ideas about what kind of spiritual significance the word should have. Yeah. So these two principles were really useful for me in translating. Oh, sorry, you forgot. I forgot the second.
What's your favorite translation on the word sati?
Oh, sati. So I use mindfulness for sati. Yeah, I think that's fine. It's all right. And the second question was about the anapanasati, yes, mindfulness of breathing. It might take a bit long to go into that in too much detail, but just from a practical point of view, I think that the way that the Buddha talks about anapanasati is much more relaxed, it's much more easeful, it's much less effortful than this idea of I'm going to make myself concentrate on an object. I mean, even the word object, right? There's no word for object in the early sutta, in the early Pali. Right? There's no, the idea of like an object of consciousness. There's no word for that. There's words in later literature that use the word aramana for that. But aramana is not used in that sense in the Pali suttas. So there's a lot of things where we tend to read ideas from later literature back into the Pali texts, and we have to always keep an open mind about that. Of course, it doesn't mean that we reject what commentaries and later texts say, because obviously we couldn't read the Pali texts without them. But it does mean that we should keep a bit of an open and a bit of a critical mind about that. Actually, which actually reminds me, I mentioned a bit earlier, the distinguishing features of my translation, and I think another distinguishing feature of my translation would be that it is somewhat less bound to the commentarial interpretations compared to, say, Bhikkhu Bodhi's. Now, I mean, not a big difference. Bhikkhu Bodhi's basically the same. You know, he wants to translate the Pali. Yes, we'd both be informed by the commentary, but sometimes he'd be more inclined to default to the commentarial meaning, and I'd be less inclined to do so. Not in every case, but just a general tendency. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, are you going to do the veneer and the Abhidharma as well? And second question, have you tried translating with other people?
Have I tried translating with other people? Okay, so first question, no, I won't be translating the veneer. My friend Ajahn Brahmali is translating the veneer, So that's good. And we have a draft of part of that is on Sutta Central already, and the full translation of that is done and it's in proofing and so on stage. So that's good. Abhidhamma, I would love to have a translation of the Abhidhamma as well as all the late books of the Kutika. We'll see if somebody wants to do it. I don't plan to do it at the moment. Yeah. I mean, the problem with translating Abhidhamma, I discussed this with Bhikkhu Bodhi actually, the problem with translating the Abhidhamma, especially the canonical Abhidhamma texts, is that the difficulty of those texts doesn't lie in the translation. The difficulty of those texts lies in the ideas and the form and the structure and how it's taught. So it's actually probably easier to learn a bit of Pali and we can read them in the original than it is to try to work out a translation. Anyway. Sorry, yes.
The second is Professor Griffith's second question about translating with other people.
Alright, sorry, yes.
I have the same question. Do you have like a Thai or Sri Lankan you know, person that you're kind of touching base with on the translations in terms of the sort of traditional interpretation or understanding and how the English sort of matches up with that?
Yeah, not formally, no. Okay. Yeah, so basically I do the translation myself, but just consulting on, you know, consulting with various people on difficult points. Yeah. But no, I mean, look, ideally, yes, you'd have a translation team, and you do it like they did the Chinese translations, where you get a team of people coming and doing it. And I really would love to do that, but I couldn't. So at the end of the day, you just got to do it the way that you can do it.
You could, just in terms of resources. And
in terms of resources.
Together.
It's really hard, because basically by the time people are sort of old enough and ugly enough to actually have the maturity to do something like this, you're basically running a monastery or a department, or you're writing your own book or something like that, to find people who've actually got the free time to commit. I mean, just to give a point of comparison, so my friends Rob Bucknell and Venerable Inalio have recently completed a translation of the Madhyama Agama from Chinese into English, being one of the first translations of a major Agama text from into English. Now, they started that project under the guidance of Marcus Bingenheimer, who was working at Dhamma Drum at the time, and Marcus pulled together a team of translators who did the first volume, which has been published. While they were doing that, basically everyone on the team dropped out. And it was just Rod and Analio left, and they did the remaining two volumes. It's just hard to get people doing that. Yeah.
And it strikes me you're able to have an... I mean, if you translated the whole Pali canon in like 2 years...
Yeah.
You know, I've worked on group translations with people. It takes forever to translate.
Yeah, it wouldn't speed up the process. You know?
Someone does what you did, right. And then, you know, the group sits around and, you know, discusses it, you know,
right.
At the rate of about a page a week.
Yeah.
You know.
Which is great, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's great to go through that process, yeah? Learning for everyone.
Yes.
But the way I tried to approach this is one of the things that I've done is I've worked closely with the forum that we have for Sutta Central, right? So we're constantly having feedback from people on the forum, and often very good feedback about mistakes and issues and things like that, discussions at different points and so on and so forth. So I tried to do so. This is very much incorporated into the translation. And unlike a traditional translation in print, which is more or less static, then for me this is something which is evolving. So, I recently, for example, retranslated Kula Putta. Hard term to translate. A lot of the hard terms are not the philosophical terms, they're the culturally bound terms, right? Kula Putta, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as clansman. I mean, if you do a Google image search for clansmen, right, you either get guys with pointy white hats or Scotsmen with kilts and beards, right? That's the kind of the image that clansmen brings up in mind. And Kula Putta has kind of it's a curious term to translate. And the basic meaning of it means the son of a family. That's very straightforward. But it has more of a culturally determined meaning, that Kula Putta means somebody who's from a good family, right? Somebody's from a respectable family. So I've tried translating it as gentleman, right? So this good gentleman is off there meditating or something like that. Now, one of the things... Oh, I keep forgetting things. My goodness, how does that happen? So one of the other things that I did in my translation is that it's a gender-neutral translation. And so this is actually a big innovation. I think it's the first time that a major Buddhist text has been translated in a gender-neutral way. Now, obviously, the English language is evolving at quite a rapid pace towards a not arbitrarily imposing gender on statements in the language. And this... One of the things to bear in mind about this is it's been driven, of course, by kind of modern social sensibilities and so on, but it's not just that. It's also being driven by especially the interaction between English and Chinese. Right? Chinese doesn't have gendered pronouns. And if you listen to people who speak, who are native Chinese speakers who speak English as a second language, they constantly mix up he and she and so on. Yeah? So this is a normal thing that language does, is that it loses these kinds of genders and so on over time, especially through the interaction of different languages. And so I believe that within, you know, 50 to 100 years, basically English will almost completely lost the gendered pronouns in the way that we're doing today. I mean, in many ways it already has. So anyway, so I try to translate in a way that would not use gendered pronouns. One of the things which had been pointed out by my friend Ananda Jyoti, another scholar who I consulted with on this project, and Venerable Analio, they pointed out that the word bhikkhu in Pali was often used in a gender-neutral way. It included both monks and nuns. So in some contexts it specifically means monks, and in some contexts it's used in a general sense to include both monks and nuns. And so I've translated bhikkhu as mendicant, because then this is a gender-neutral translation. It's also a translation which is very literal, because where bhikkhu means an alms mendicant, someone who's wandering for alms. Now, of course, that's context-dependent. And Venerable Brahmali, when he's translating the Vinaya, retained monk for bhikkhu and nun for bhikkhuni, because in the Vinaya it's essential to distinguish, because that's how the Vinaya is structured. But in the suttas, most of the time you don't really need to make that distinction, though of course if you do need to make it, then of course you make that distinction. But where you don't need to, then you don't keep the gendered text. Okay, so we're running out of time here. I've only just got started. One of the things that I would like to just draw to your attention, looks like we're not going to have time to discuss it, because I think we're finishing at 7:30, right?
Yes,
that's great. So while doing this, I made about 130 essays about the translation. So if you're interested to look at some, these are just points of interest that came up while I was doing my translation. And so if you're interested in some of the issues that I have been talking about and would like to look in a bit more detail about these things, then you can have a look at our forum, discourse.sutacentral.net, and under the tag EBT-translation, EBT standing for Early Buddhist Texts. And there's a whole bunch of things. And I have a few minutes, don't I? I have a few minutes. Okay, I will just go through one of those points for you as an example of what these are, and it follows on from that point about the gendered translations. Some of you may be familiar with the text of Majjhima Nikaya number 37, the Chula Dhamma Sankhaya Sutta, and in that discourse, Saka, the king of gods, comes down to see the Buddha, and the Buddha gives him a teaching. He goes back up to heaven. Mahamoggallana thinks, did he learn that teaching? Or was he paying attention? And so he goes up to quiz Saka in his heaven. And when Moggallana goes up to teach him, then, as it says here, the celestial maiden. So, of course, in the ancient Indian sort of cosmological system, if you're a big, powerful bloke like Saka, you have all of these divine maidens who are there to attend upon you. Okay. Now, when they saw Moggallana coming, the celestial maidens each go to their own rooms. And here are the various translations of that. So the Saka's handmaidens fled in fear and shame. Okay, so Abhihorna, they fled shrinking and shy. Venerable Upalavanna, with remorse and shame. Nyanamoli, conscience-stricken and ashamed. And Venerable Bodhi, embarrassed and ashamed. Not to put too fine a point on it, these translations are all sexist as hell. I mean, seriously, right? The Pali is that they were otapati harayati. Right? They had otapamana hiriyamana. And otapa and hiri are always used in a positive sense in Buddhism. Absolutely universally. There's not a single exception to that. Hiri and Otapa are the guardians of the world. They're the foundations for all good deeds. And when the text says that these divine maidens possess these universally good qualities, how are we translating that as fleeing in fear and shame? I mean, you get this idea that these kind of giggling bimbos who are running off when Mogalana's coming in. I mean, Mogalana's a guest in their home. And not to forget that if you are reborn in that heaven, you're only reborn in that heaven because of your good karma. They've done good deeds in their past. They're reborn in a good birth in that life with a husband who studies Dhamma. I mean, Saka doesn't seem like he was too bad of a guy, right? And then what have they got to be ashamed of? Right? So these things, they can... And when I'd read this passage before, you always just read it. You thought, oh, that's what it says. And then I'm looking at it, actually, that's not what it says at all. Saka's maidens, being prudent and discreet, each went to their own room. Okay, so they saw that Saka, the lord of the house, was having a discussion with Mogalana. The monk had come to speak to him. And so to leave them alone with their discussion, they went back to their rooms and allowed them to have their discussion. Yeah. So this is just one little detail. You know, two words in one sutta. And when you're translating many suttas, then you constantly come across these kinds of things. So if you're interested in some of the ones here, many of these, I have to admit, are very boring, but some of them may be more interesting. For example, I have a nice discussion on the question which has bothered many of you. For example, such as... sorry, I'm looking for one particular one. Oh, there's the Celestial Maidens one. Yeah, so here's one of my favourite ones. Did naked ascetics spank each other's bottoms? So that, I know, is something that has been of concern, probably, to you. Anyway, so if you're interested to learn more about my process of translation and the various issues which I dealt with and tried to overcome, then there's some resources for you there. So, this work is only possible because of the help and support by so many people. And personally, I feel very blessed and very honoured to be able to have the chance to do this. And I hope that through my work, I have made the Dhamma available to people to some small degree, and I hope that I can contribute so that the next translator can come along and look at my work and think, oh my God, that's so awful, and then do a much better job in the future. That's my highest aspiration. So thank you so much, everybody here, for attending. Thanks to the Host Center for Buddhist Studies for hosting the event, and to Paul for the introduction, and I wish you all the best, and be happy.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.